McClellan be relieved from the command of the Army of the Potomac, and that Major General Burnside take the command of that army, by order of the Secretary of War. Neither of the orders being really any stronger than the other, it appeared that the young Napoleon's superiors considered two blows likelier to floor him than just one. However that might have been, he kept his balance under the double impact. He read both sheets, then said with a smile and in the same pleasant tone as before, "Well, Burnside, I turn the command over to you." Close to tears, the Indiana-born Rhode Islander implored McClellan to stay with him for a day or two while he began to get accustomed to handling the reins. He had not wanted this job, had in fact refused it twice already, pleading incompetence, and once again this evening when Buckingham first came to Salem. That was why they had arrived so late. He had spent 2 hours arguing against his appointment. But Buckingham had reminded him that this was no request, it was a double-barreled order. He had no choice. Besides, the staff brigadier had added, if Burnside declined the command, it would go to Hooker. That decided it. He had accepted, and all he asked now was that little Mac stay with him for a couple of days to help him get settled in the driver's seat. McClellan agreed, and the two generals went back out into the snowy night. Alone again, the deposed commander took up his pen and returned to his letter. Another interruption, this time more important. It was in the shape of Burnside, accompanied by General Buckingham. "Alas for my poor country! I know in my inmost heart she never had a truer servant." He did not say, as he had said before, that this was a temporary step down, that he would be recalled when things went as wrong for Burnside as they had gone for Pope. He was through, and he knew it. But he added, "Do not be at all worried. I am not. I have done the best I could for my country. To the last, I have done my duty as I understand it. That I must have made many mistakes, I cannot deny. I do not see any great blunders, but no one can judge of himself. Our consolation must be that we have tried to do what was right." All that really remained to be done was to say goodbye to the army whose affection for him was, in the end, his most enduring monument. Next day, when the order for his removal was published, the reaction combined disbelief and horror, both of which gave way to rage, which in turn was tempered by sadness. The various corps, drawn up for a farewell exchange of salutes, broke ranks as they had done before at his approach. Now, as before, they crowded around him, touched his boots, and stroked the flanks of his horse. Only this time the tears were produced by sorrow, not by jubilation. Nor had all the anger been drained off. "Send him back! Send him back!" they cried in his wake, as if their shouts could be heard in the capital, 50 miles away. The Irish brigade cast its colors in the dust for him to ride over. But of course, one observer wrote, he made them take them up again. The same man heard a general say he wished to God that McClellan would put himself at the head of the army and throw the infernal scoundrels at Washington into the Potomac. Another yelled, "Lead us to Washington, General, we'll follow you." Burnside shared the prevailing gloom, still so badly choked up that when one division commander, having voiced his regrets to McClellan, turned to him and offered congratulations, the new army head could hardly speak. "Couch, don't say a word about it," he implored. McClellan accepted this adulation with as much satisfaction as ever, possibly more, but he remained strangely calm in the midst of it, and did nothing to encourage the various expressions of resentment. "The officers and men feel terribly about the change," he wrote his wife on the second night after receiving the order for his removal. "I learned today that the men are very sullen and have lost their good spirits entirely." This was putting it mildly indeed, but the truth was, he had lost much of his former flamboyance. Even his written farewell to his soldiers was comparatively restrained. "In you I have never found doubt or coldness," he told them, and he added, "We shall ever be comrades in supporting the Constitution of our country and the nationality of its people." That was all, or almost all. November 11th he took his final leave of them, riding down to Warrenton Junction, where a train was waiting to carry him away. After receiving the salute of a 2,000-man detachment stationed here, he boarded the train and took his seat. But before the engineer could obey the highball, the troops broke ranks, surrounded the car, then uncoupled it and ran it back, yelling threats against the administration and insisting that McClellan should not leave. One word, one look of encouragement, the lifting of a finger, one witness later declared, would have been a signal for a revolt against lawful authority, the consequences of which no man can measure. Instead, McClellan stepped onto the front platform and delivered a short address to the men, who had fallen silent as soon as he appeared. "Stand by General Burnside as you have stood by me, and all will be well," he said. Calmed, the soldiers recoupled the car and the train pulled out, followed by one long and mournful huzzah as the men bade farewell to their late commander. His route led through the capital, but he had already told his wife, "I shall not stop in Washington longer than for the next train, and will not go to see anybody." In their tears, in their passionate demonstrations of affection for this man who moved them in a way no other general ever had or ever would, it was as if the soldiers had sensed a larger meaning in the impending separation. It was as if they knew they were saying goodbye to something more than just one stocky, brown-haired man astride a tall black horse. It was indeed as if they were saying goodbye to their youth, which in a sense they were. Or it might also have been prescience, intimations of mortality, intimations of suffering down the years. There had been Pope, and now it appeared that there would be others more or less like him. Knowing what that meant, they might well have been weeping for their own lot as well as for McClellan's. "My army," he had called them from the start, and it was true. He had made them into what they were, and whatever they accomplished, he would accomplish too, in part, even though he would no longer be at their head. That was no doubt his greatest satisfaction, but there were others no less welcome for being delayed. 5 years after the guns had cooled and were parked in town squares and on courthouse lawns, with sparrows building nests in their muzzles, he received what was perhaps his finest professional compliment, and received it from the man who had occupied the best of all possible positions from which to formulate a judgment. Asked then who was the ablest federal general he had opposed throughout the war, Robert E. Lee replied without hesitation, "McClellan, by all odds." McClellan was gone, and others were gone with him. Fitzjohn Porter, for example, who was relieved from command by authority of the same message Lincoln had sent Halleck on November 5th, relieving Little Mac. His corps went to Hooker, whose own had been severely cut up at Antietam, and Porter himself was brought back to Washington to face charges for having failed to obey Pope's order for an attack on the Confederate right at or near Manassas in the state of Virginia, on or about the 29th day of August 1862. The court having convicted him, Lincoln ordered that he be cashiered and dismissed from the service, and forever disqualified from holding any office of trust or profit under the government of the United States. Winged thus by a stray pellet from the blast that felled his chief, Porter had to wait long for vindication. It came at last, officially, nearly a quarter of a century later, when Congress in 1886 commissioned him a regular army colonel to rank from 1861 and permitted him to retire immediately thereafter without back pay but with honor. One other major figure was to go, though not entirely. Benjamin Butler was too useful a man and too powerful a politician to be assigned to limbo alongside Buell and McClellan. Like them, he was a Democrat, but he was blatantly so, with the result that what had been for them a disadvantage was for him a downright blessing. So long as he occupied a high position in the army, the administration could not be accused of conducting a strictly Republican war, whereas his dismissal would have exactly the reverse effect. Butler, of course, was aware of this advantage and operated accordingly. What was more, he was efficient, particularly as an administrator. Yet for all his ingenuity in dealing with the problems attending the occupation of New Orleans, He had not only succeeded in making the Creoles fear the stripes in his flag, he had also brought them some of the sanitary benefits of Lowell, Massachusetts, including an intensive flushing out of their sewers and an equally intensive regulation of their morals. The squint-eyed general had not fulfilled his early promise as a terror to the rebels in the field. Of late, in fact, he had entirely neglected that side of military life, even having gone so far as to pull his troops out of Baton Rouge in order to avoid a return engagement with the Confederates who had attacked the place in early August. Obviously, he would not do for the bloody work Lincoln now saw would have to be done if the war was ever to end. However, the disposition of Butler was no large problem. His talents were so manifold that he would be about as useful in one place as another. He could be shifted. Fortunately for Lincoln's purpose, he had a replacement there at hand in the form of the commander of the Washington defenses. Banks, like Butler, was a Massachusetts politician, so that to exchange them one for another would not upset the voters of their region. Besides, Banks was resourceful, energetic, and pugnacious, a combination of qualities all too rare of late, in more places than New Orleans. In short, he was just the kind of man Lincoln thought he wanted for the job he had in mind. It was true that wherever he had fought he had been whipped, sometimes rather spectacularly, but this had not been the result of any unwillingness to fight, quite the reverse. And generally it had been against Stonewall Jackson, whom he would be unlikely to encounter down in Louisiana or up the Mississippi. That was where Lincoln intended to send him. On November 8th, the day after Buckingham left for Rectortown with the orders placing Burnside in command of the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln had the Adjutant General issue an order assigning Banks to the command of the Department of the Gulf, including the state of Texas, and the following day he had Halleck write the new commander a letter of instructions, explaining the purpose, or, more strictly speaking, purposes, for which he was being transferred so far south. Vicksburg and Mobile were to be his primary objectives, and he was to have the cooperation of the Navy in effecting their reduction. The President regards the opening of the Mississippi River as the first and most important of all our military and naval operations, he was told, and it is hoped that you will not lose a moment in accomplishing it. Following this, Halleck continued, quite as if the thing had been done already with a flourish of the pen, Banks was to move eastward from Vicksburg to Jackson, and thus cut off all connection by rail between northern Mississippi and Atlanta, the chief military depot of the rebel armies in the West. This done, he would return approximately to his starting point in order to ascend with a naval and military force the Red River as far as it is navigable, and thus open an outlet for the sugar and cotton of northern Louisiana. Not even then did Halleck allow him time for a breather. It is also suggested that having Red River in our possession, it would form the best base for operations in Texas. There, at last, he closed with the assurance, "These instructions are not intended to tie your hands or to hamper your operations in the slightest degree, and I need not assure you, General, that the government has unlimited confidence not only in your judgment and discretion, but also in your energy and military promptness." Although this was clearly one of the largest tasks ever assigned a commander in all the history of warfare, and unquestionably the most difficult ever assigned a non-professional who, after 18 months in the field and a major share in 3 campaigns, lacked so much as a single tactical victory to his credit, Banks shared Halleck's unlimited confidence that the thing could be done and that he was the man to do it. Summoned to Washington and informed that he would be given 20,000 reinforcements to accompany him on the coastal voyage to New Orleans, one expeditionary force would sail from New York, the other from Hampton Roads, the New Englander was delighted. "Everything is favorable for my purpose," he had replied to an earlier warning order. "I shall obtain troops at once and be ready for movement as early as you wish. Requisitions will be made and forwarded by mail. No material delay will occur unless for want of transports. Now, having conferred in person with Lincoln and Halleck as to the details of the multifaceted project, he was more enthusiastic than ever. There was much to do, he said as he departed for New York, but he would lose no time. Lincoln was delighted, too, not only by the prospect of seeing so much accomplished, but also by the unfamiliar experience of having sat face to face with a commander who recognized the worth of time and the military fruits that haste could gather. Moreover, it augured well for larger matters. For all the vastness of the project thus assigned to Banks, the main value of his operations would be diversionary, serving, one, to drain off rebel frontline troops by threatening their rear, and two, to distract the enemy high command from concentrating against the federal main effort about to be exerted against their front. After 100,000 casualties and a year and a half of successes, near successes, and sickening failures, the last, as Lincoln saw them, being mainly due to the vacillation and non-aggressiveness of generals like Buell and McClellan, who, desiring combat less than they feared defeat, believed in preparation more than they believed in movement, a victory pattern had emerged. Three southern cities were the three main northern objectives. Richmond, Chattanooga, and Vicksburg were the brain, heart, and bowels of the rebellion. A successful blow struck any one of the three might well prove fatal in time, to the corpus as a whole, but three successful blows, struck simultaneously, would produce immediate results. Whatever movement followed then on the part of the creature named Rebellion would be no more than death throes and the setting in of rigor mortis. Immediate results being what he was after, Lincoln had assigned these three main objectives to the commanders of the three main armies of the Union, Burnside, Rosecrans, and Grant. He himself had chosen the first and second, and he had sustained the third against strident demands for his dismissal, saying of him, "I can't spare this man. He fights." He believed he could say it of the other two as well. Whatever shortcomings they might develop under pressure, Grant's, for instance, was said to be whiskey, hearing which the president was supposed to have asked what brand he drank, intending to send a barrel each to all his other generals. It seemed unlikely that a distaste for combat was going to be the flaw in any case. All three had fought and fought hard. Burnside at Roanoke Island and Antietam, Rosecrans in West Virginia and at Corinth, Grant at Belmont, Donelson, and Shiloh, which was practically to call the roll of all the victories the army could lay claim to east of the Mississippi, even by stretching the point in an instance or two or three. So had Banks fought hard, and though admittedly it had been with less success, Lincoln believed that the war had reached a stage where hard fighting, sustained by the superior resources of the nation, would create its own success. At any rate, that was what he was asking for now, hard fighting, and with this in mind, as commander-in-chief, he had placed his major armies under leaders he considered most likely to give it to him without delay. So he thought, this melancholy man with his incurable optimism, only to find that what his high hopes mainly afforded him, once more, alas, was another occasion for exploring the gap that yawned between conception and execution. One by one, two by two, and finally all four together, his hand-picked generals failed his expectations as to haste. And, paradoxically, he discovered that the reason for delay in all four cases was just those superior resources which he had thought assured them victory. Banks was first, the most enthusiastic of the lot. He had scarcely been gone from the capital a week before the president saw a monster requisition the Massachusetts general submitted, calling for mountains of supplies and thousands of horses to haul them through the jungles of the lower South. Horses were a sore subject with Lincoln just now, anyhow, and when he was assured by the chief quartermaster that the requisition could not be filled and got off within an hour short of 2 months, he wrote Banks a letter in which anger vied with sorrow for predominance. "I have just been overwhelmed and confounded," he declared, and continued, "My dear General, this expanding and piling up of impedimenta has been so far almost our ruin, and will be our final ruin if it is not abandoned. When you parted with me, you had no such ideas in your mind. I know you had not, or you could not have expected to be off so soon as you said. You must get back to something like the plan you had then, or your expedition is a failure before you start. You must be off before Congress meets. You would be better off anywhere, and especially where you are going, for not having 1,000 wagons doing nothing but hauling forage to feed the animals that draw them, and taking at least 2,000 men to care for the wagons and animals, who otherwise might be 2,000 good soldiers." In closing, he added a further admonition. "Now, dear General, do not think this is an ill-natured letter. It is the very reverse. The simple publication of this requisition would ruin you." As usual, in cases where the offense presaged delay, Banks had what he considered a reasonable explanation. 2 days later, November 24th, he replied that the request for supplies was drawn up by an officer who did not fully comprehend my instructions and inadvertently approved by me without sufficient examination. In other words, he had signed without looking. "My purpose has not been changed since I left Washington," he assured Lincoln, "and I have waited for nothing not absolutely necessary." Apparently, though, a great many items fell in that category, for the waiting continued. Banks kept saying he would be off any day now, but the disillusioned president had doubts. And his doubts were valid. Banks's purpose might not have changed, but his schedule had. November went out, December came in. Banks remained at his New York starting point. Finally, on December 4th, he sailed for Fort Monroe. How long he would stay there before continuing on to New Orleans, Lincoln did not know. Anyhow, he had a good deal more on his mind by then. Troubles of a similar nature, involving delay but derived from a different and even more unexpected source, were looming in the West, specifically in Grant's department, and even more specifically in U.S. Grant himself. After the ill-wind fiasco at Iuka and the bloody repulse of the rebels at Corinth, which he had missed, Grant had been sounding oddly unlike himself. When Halleck, after the latter fight, asked why he did not press the defeated and retreating foe, "Why order a return of our troops? Why not pursue the enemy into Mississippi, supporting your army on the country?" Grant replied that an army could not subsist itself on the country except in forage. Disaster would follow in the end. This did not sound like the Grant of old, who never spoke of disaster except with the intention of inflicting it. And presently he was sounding even less so, calling urgently for reinforcements in expectation of having to fight another battle. This fall, in fact, his aggressive instincts mostly seemed reserved for the Jews in his department. "Refuse all permits to come south of Jackson for the present," he wired Hurlbut at that place, adding, "The Israelites especially should be kept out." He instructed his railroad superintendent to give orders to all conductors on the road that no Jews are to be permitted to travel on the railroad southward from any point. They may go north and be encouraged in it, but they are such an intolerable nuisance that the department must be purged of them. Lincoln would not have admired this talk of purges, not only because it ran counter to his personal belief in the equality of men before the law, whether the law was military or civil, but also because it could be applied to a father or mother on the way to visit a soldier's son. For there were, of course, Jewish soldiers in all the nation's armies, even Grant's. In time, this would be called to his attention, but for the present, Lincoln was disturbed enough at the general's tone in regard to the pursuit of a beaten foe. One explanation was given by Rosecrans in a private letter to Halleck, written on the day before he was ordered north to replace Buell. He complained of the spirit of mischief among the mousing politicians on Grant's staff, spoke of Grant becoming sour and reticent, and asked to be relieved from duty here. When a fighter Lincoln respected as much as he did Rosecrans asked for a transfer, apparently all was not well in the area he wished himself away from. Also, as always, there was talk that Grant had reverted to his old fondness for the bottle. Doubtless, too, Lincoln heard gossip similar to what a Chicago reporter heard from his fellow passengers as he rode south about this time on a train bound for Memphis. Officers and men returning from leaves and furloughs declared that Grant never did amount to anything and never would. He had been kicked out of the United States Army once and would be again. He was nothing but a drunken, wooden-headed tanner that would not trouble the country very long, etc., etc. Whatever his past successes, Vicksburg was too important a prize for its capture to hinge entirely on the problematic advance of a man who was the subject of so many ugly rumors, and whose character, even aside from the truth or falseness of such talk, seemed to have undergone a discouraging reversal. At any rate, Lincoln in this case had provided not one but two extra strings for the bow that was to be bent in that direction. While Banks was moving upriver against the place, supported by warships from Farragut's fleet, and Grant was marching overland down the Mississippi Central from Grand Junction, a third force was to descend the river from southern Illinois, its mission being to cooperate with Porter's ironclad flotilla for an attack on the stronghold which Jefferson Davis had called the Gibraltar of the West. This third force was irregular and highly secret in nature, its purpose known only to three men, Lincoln, Stanton, and its commander, John McClernand. They had created it out of whole cloth, so to speak. McClernand had come north on leave in late September, saying privately that he was tired of furnishing brains for Grant's army, and it appealed to his friend the president to let one volunteer officer try his abilities. In accordance with the plan he submitted, Stanton gave him on October 21st a confidential order authorizing him to proceed to the states of Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, and to organize the troops remaining in those states and to be raised by volunteering or draft, to the end that, when a sufficient force not required by the operations of General Grant's command shall be raised, an expedition may be organized under General McClernand's command against Vicksburg, to clear the Mississippi River and open navigation to New Orleans. A presidential endorsement further authorized him to show this confidential document to governors and even others when in his discretion he believes so doing to be indispensable to the progress of the expedition. Armed with this order, which he saw as placing his star in the ascendant, his ambition had not been lessened by the singeing he took at Donelson while seeking the bubble reputation at the cannon's mouth. McClernand left for his home state in late October, there to begin assembling the force which he believed would put him not only in Vicksburg, but also in the White House. Even the first of these steps would take time, however, and time, he knew, was the foe of secrecy. Sure enough, by early November, Grant began hearing what he called mysterious rumors of McClernand's command. Glad as he had been to get rid of his fellow Illinoisan, he did not want him back in his department at the head of a rival army. When Halleck, whom the three lawyers had also not let in on their secret, informed him that Memphis would be made the depot of a joint military and naval expedition on Vicksburg, Grant took alarm and wired back, "Am I to understand that I lie still here while an expedition is fitted out from Memphis, or do you want me to push as far south as possible? Am I to have Sherman move subject to my orders, or is he and his forces reserved for some special service?" Halleck replied blandly, "You have command of all troops sent to your department, and have permission to fight the enemy where you please." That was enough for Grant. Receiving Halleck's go-ahead message near Grand Junction on November 11th, he had cavalry in Holly Springs 2 days later. He followed at once with the infantry, established a supply base there, and continued his advance down the Mississippi Central. By December 1st, his cavalry was across the Hatchie, the rebels fading back. Still Grant followed. Within another week he had occupied Oxford, 50 miles beyond his starting point, setting up a command post in the courthouse and repairing the railroad in his rear. Whatever else McClernand's behind-the-scenes maneuver might accomplish in the end, it had affected at least one thing before it even got beyond the plans and training stage. Grant's mind had emerged from the tunnel it had entered after Shiloh. He was himself again, or anyhow he appeared to be, and this in itself was encouraging to Lincoln. However, he could also see that in North Mississippi, as elsewhere along the 1,000-mile front, the fine autumn weather had mostly gone to waste so far as offensive operations were concerned. Grant was still 150 airline miles from Vicksburg, and neither Banks nor McClernand had even begun to move. Here in the east, delay was especially discouraging for being close at hand. Lincoln's torture, as a result, was not unlike that of Tantalus, who saw the surface of the pool recede each time he bent to drink. In this case, too, he was soon obliged to suspect that he had made an error in personal judgment, no matter how well-founded that judgment had seemed at the time he acted on it. In addition to native combativeness, demonstrated on independent service, Burnside had other qualities which had caused Lincoln to overrule his twice-repeated protest that he was not competent to command the Army of the Potomac, despite the fact that his rank entitled him to the post. Less than 3 years older than McClellan, he had been his friend before and during the war and had taken no part in the bickering that surrounded him. It was Lincoln's hope that this would ease the blow and soften the reaction when McClellan's bodyguard got the news that its hero had been replaced. Also, Burnside had no political opinions, a lack that might have been expected to spare him the mistrust and enmity of the Jacobins who had hounded his predecessor. Both calculations, one regarding the army, the other Congress, appeared to have been valid at the outset. For a time, they even worked, or else they seemed to. But the president was not long in finding out that both had been something less than inclusive. According to one general in a group who came to congratulate Burnside on his promotion, he thanked them, and then, with that transparent sincerity which made everyone believe what he said, he added that he knew he was not fit for so big a command, but he would do his best. The witness remarked, "One could not help feeling a certain tenderness for the man," but when a moment later the generals talked among themselves, it was no wonder that several shook their heads and asked how we could have confidence in the fitness of our leader if he had no such confidence in himself. Such, in part, was the reaction in the army he was about to lead into battle. As for the radicals in Congress, it soon became apparent that an absence of politics was by no means a recommendation in their eyes. They had no objection to politics per se, they merely insisted that the politics be Republican. All they really knew of Burnside was that he was the acknowledged friend of the man whose ruin they were proud to have helped accomplish— and they were prepared to do as much for him in turn if on closer acquaintance it appeared that he deserved it. Such objections were mainly personal, however, and Lincoln did not share them, or if he did, he thought them incidental. His main concern was with Burnside as a strategist, a seeker after battle, which was where his doubts came in. Aware that the president wanted immediate action, and had in fact removed his predecessor for not giving it to him, the new commander immediately prepared a plan which he submitted for approval. Not liking the army's present location, which seemed to him uncomfortably similar to the one John Pope had occupied before he came to grief, Burnside had the notion of converting the advance just east of the Blue Ridge into a feint, under cover of which he would accumulate a 4 or 5 days' supply for the men and animals, then make a rapid move of the whole force to Fredericksburg, with a view to a movement upon Richmond from that point. This was the so-called covering approach, which Lincoln had always favored, since it protected Washington. But in this case, he thought the plan defective, in that it made the southern capital the primary federal objective, not Lee's army, which in fact it seemed that Burnside was attempting to avoid. Halleck felt that way about it too, and on November 12th went down to Warrenton for a talk with the lush-whiskered general, who argued forcefully in favor of the change of base. Still doubtful, Halleck returned to Washington and reported the discussion to the president. Lincoln, too, was unconvinced, but he was so pleased at the prospect of early action, here in the East if nowhere else, that he agreed to let Burnside go ahead, or more strictly speaking sideways, then ahead, provided he moved fast. Halleck passed the word to Warrenton on the 14th. "The president has just assented to your plan. He thinks that it will succeed if you move very rapidly, otherwise not." Burnside did move rapidly, very rapidly. Despite the tremendous supply problems which went with having an aggregate present of approximately 250,000 officers and men, for whose welfare he was responsible, 150,441 in the field force proper, 98,738 in the capital defenses, the fact was he had turned out to be an excellent administrator. On the day he received Lincoln's qualified assent to an eastward shift, he regrouped his seven corps into right, left, and center grand divisions of two corps each, respectively under Sumner, Franklin, and Hooker, leaving the seventh in independent reserve under Sigel. With his army thus reorganized for deft handling, he took up the march for Falmouth the following day, November 15th. Sumner went first, followed on subsequent days by Franklin, Hooker, and the cavalry. Moving down the north bank of the Rappahannock, which thus covered the exposed flank of the column, the right Grand Division arrived on the 17th, and the others came along behind on schedule. Burnside himself reached Falmouth on the 19th, just in advance of the rearguard elements. Proudly he wired Washington, "Sumner's two corps now occupy all the commanding positions opposite Fredericksburg. The enemy do not seem to be in force." So far, indeed, except for an occasional gray cavalry vedette across the way, the only sign of resistance had come from a single rebel battery on the heights beyond the historic South Bank town, and it had been smothered promptly by counter-battery fire. Lincoln had asked for speed, and Burnside had given it to him. He seemed about to give him all else he had asked for, too, hard fighting, for he added, "As soon as the pontoon trains arrive, the bridge will be built and the command moved over." But there was the rub. Burnside had left the sending of the pontoons to Halleck, who in turn had left it to a subordinate, and somewhere along the chain of command the word "rush" had been dropped from the requisition. The army waited a week, during which a three-day rain swelled the fords and turned the roads into troughs of mud. Still the pontoons did not come. On the eighth day they got there, but so by then had something else, something not nearly so welcome. Had the pontoon bridge arrived even on the 19th or 20th, the army could have crossed with trifling opposition, Burnside notified Halleck on the 22nd. But now the opposite side of the river is occupied by a large rebel force under General Longstreet, with batteries ready to be placed in position to operate against the working parties building the bridge and the troops in crossing. Vexed that his 40-mile change of base, executed with such efficiency and speed that it had given him the jump on his wily opponent, had gained him nothing by way of surprise in the end, he said flatly, "I deem it my duty to lay these facts before you and to say that I cannot make the promise of probable success with the faith that I did when I supposed that all the parts of the plan would be carried out. The president said that the movement, in order to be successful, must be made quickly, and I thought the same." Lincoln was distressed, not only because of the delay, which he had predicted would be fatal to the success of the campaign, but also because the new commander, in the face of all those guns across the river, seemed to believe it was part of his duty to expose his army to annihilation by way of payment for other men's mistakes. November 25th, the day the first relay of pontoons reached Falmouth, the president wired, "If I should be in a boat off Aquia Creek at dark tomorrow, Wednesday, evening, could you, without inconvenience, meet me and pass an hour or two with me?" He made the trip, saw Burnside and the situation, which he characterized by understatement as somewhat risky, then returned to Washington, worked out a supplementary plan of his own, and sent for the general to come up and discuss it with him and Halleck. As he saw it, the enemy should be confused by diversionary attacks, one upstream from Fredericksburg, the other on the lower Pamunkey, each to be delivered by a force of about 25,000 men and the latter to be supported by the fleet. Both generals rejected the plan, however, on grounds that it would require too much time for preparation. So Lincoln, with his argument stressing haste thus turned against him, had to content himself with telling Burnside to go back to his army and use his own judgment as to when and where he would launch an assault across the Rappahannock. Burnside returned to Falmouth on the next to last day of November. His notion was to strike where Lee would least expect it, and the more he thought about the problem, the more it seemed to him that this would be at Fredericksburg itself, where Lee was strongest. Accordingly, he began to mass his 113,000 effectives, Sigel having been posted near Manassas, along and behind the North Bank Heights, overlooking the streets of the Rappahannock town whose citizens had already been given notice to evacuate their homes. November was gone by then, however. In the east as in the west, to Lincoln's sorrow, there had been no fall offensive, only a seemingly endless preparation for one which had not come off. Between these two east-west extremes, the trouble in Middle Tennessee, while similar to the trouble in Virginia and North Mississippi, was in its way even more exasperating. Burnside and Grant at least regretted the delay and expressed a willingness to end it. But Rosecrans not only would not say that he regretted it, he declared flatly that he would not obey a direct order to end it until he personally was convinced that his hard-marched army was ready for action, down to the final shoe nail and the final pair of shoes. This came as a shock to Lincoln, who had expected old Rosie's positivism to take a different form. He would have been less surprised, no doubt, if he had known Grant's reaction when that general learned in late October that his then subordinate was leaving. "I was delighted," he later wrote, adding, "I found that I could not make him do as I wished, and had determined to relieve him from duty that very day." Whatever reasons lay behind Rosecrans's reluctance to move forward, they could not have proceeded from any vagueness in his instructions, which were covered in a letter Halleck sent him along with his appointment as Buell's successor. "The great objects to be kept in view in your operations in the field are, first, to drive the enemy from Kentucky and Middle Tennessee, second, to take and hold East Tennessee, cutting the line of railroad at Chattanooga, Cleveland, or Athens, so as to destroy the connection of the Valley of Virginia with Georgia and the other southern states. It is hoped that by prompt and rapid movements a considerable part of this may be accomplished before the roads become impassable from the winter rains." After emphasizing the importance of moving light and rapidly, and also the necessity of procuring as many of your supplies as possible in the country passed over, the general-in-chief concluded on an even sterner note, "I need not urge upon you the necessity of giving active employment to your forces. Neither the country nor the government will much longer put up with the inactivity of some of our armies and generals." There he had it, schedule and all. Even the name of the army was changed, so that what had been called the Army of the Ohio was now the Army of the Cumberland, signifying the progress made, as well as the progress looked forward to. He knew well enough that Buell had been relieved because the authorities in Washington lacked confidence in his inclination or ability to get these missions accomplished in a hurry. That, too, in addition to the reluctance shown in declining the same appointment a month before, was why Thomas had been passed over in order to give the job to Rosecrans, whom they apparently considered the man to get it done. As a sign of this confidence, Halleck at once agreed to let him do what he had been unwilling to grant Buell. That is, he allowed him to return to Nashville with the army, agreeing at last with Buell's old contention that this was the best starting point for an advance on Chattanooga. Having won this concession, Rosecrans moved into the fortified Tennessee capital, and while Butternut cavalry under Morgan and Forrest tore up tracks in his rear and slashed at his front, he set about reorganizing his command, more or less in the manner of Burnside, into right, left, and center wings of four divisions each, Gilbert having faded back into the obscurity he came out of, these went respectively to McCook, Crittenden, and Thomas. The mid-November effective strength of the army was 74,555 men, as large or larger, it was thought, than the enemy force at Murfreesboro, 30-odd miles southeast, but Rosecrans still had not advanced beyond the outskirts of Nashville. He was hoping, he said, for a sudden rise of the Tennessee River to cut off the rebels' retreat, in which case, as he put it, "I shall throw myself on their right flank and endeavor to make an end of them." "For the present, however," he confided, "I am trying to lull them into security that I do not intend soon to move until I can get the railroad fully opened and throw in a couple of millions of rations here." The Confederates might be lulled by his apparent inactivity, but his own superiors were not. Alarmed by this casual reference to a couple of millions of rations, followed as it was by urgent requisitions for revolving rifles, back pay, an iron pontoon train long enough to cross the Tennessee, and much else, Halleck told him sternly on November 27th, "I must warn you against this piling up of impediments. Take a lesson from the enemy. Move light." The Tennessee commander protested that he was asking for nothing that was not indispensable to an effectual and steady advance, which is the only one that will avail us anything worth the cost. By now it was December, and Rosecrans had begun to sound more like Buell than Buell himself had done. Halleck lost his temper, wiring curtly, "The president is very impatient. Twice have I been asked to designate someone else to command your army. If you remain one more week in Nashville, I cannot prevent your removal." Rosecrans, unintimidated, bristled back at him, "Your dispatch received. I reply in few but earnest words. I have lost no time. Everything I have done was necessary, absolutely so, and has been done as rapidly as possible. If the government which ordered me here confides in my judgment, it may rely on my continuing to do what I've been trying to do, that is, my whole duty. If my superiors have lost confidence in me, they had better at once put someone in my place and let the future test the propriety of the change. I have but one word to add, which is that I need no other stimulus to make me do my duty than the knowledge of what it is. To threats of removal or the like, I must be permitted to say that I am insensible." Now Lincoln knew the worst. With autumn gone and winter at hand, not a single one of the three major blows he had hoped for and designed had been struck. Right, left, and center, for all he knew, and he had observed signs of this with his own eyes down on the Rappahannock, all that had been accomplished in each of these three critical theaters was a fair-weather setting of the stage for a foul-weather disaster. Halleck was saying of him during this first week in December, "You can hardly conceive his great anxiety," and Lincoln himself had told a friend the week before, "I certainly have been dissatisfied with the slowness of Buell and McClellan, but before I relieved them I had great fears I should not find successors to them who would do better, and I am sorry to add that I have seen little since to relieve those fears." These words were written in a letter to Carl Schurz, a young German emigrant whom the Republican Central Committee had sent to Illinois 4 years ago to speak in Lincoln's behalf during the senatorial race against Douglas. Grateful for this, and later more successful work, Lincoln appointed him minister to Spain in 1861, and when Schurz resigned to come home and fight, the president made him a brigadier under Fremont in the Alleghenies. After the fall election returns were in, he wrote Lincoln his belief that they were a most serious reproof to the administration for placing the nation's armies in the hands of its enemies, meaning Democrats. "What Republican has ever had a fair chance in this war?" Schurz asked, apparently leaving his own case out of account, and urged, "Let us be commanded by generals whose heart is in the war." Lincoln thought this over and replied, "I have just received and read your letter of November 20th. The purport of it is that we lost the late elections and the administration is failing because the war is unsuccessful, and that I must not flatter myself that I am not justly to blame for it. I certainly know that if the war fails, the administration fails, and that I will be blamed for it whether I deserve it or not. And I ought to be blamed if I could do better. You think I could do better, therefore you blame me already. I think I could not do better, therefore I blame you for blaming me. Having thus disposed of the matter of blame, he passed on to the matter of hearts. I understand you now to be willing to accept the help of men who are not Republicans, provided they have heart in it. Agreed. I want no others. But who is to be the judge of hearts, or of heart in it? If I must discard my own judgment and take yours, I must also take that of others. And by the time I should reject all I should be advised to reject, I should have none left, Republicans or others, not even yourself. For be assured, my dear sir, there are men who have heart in it that think you are performing your part as poorly as you think I am performing mine. I wish to disparage no one, certainly not those who sympathize with me, but I must say I need success more than I need sympathy, and that I have not seen the so much greater evidence of getting success from my sympathizers than from those who are denounced as the contrary. He closed with a suggestion that the citizen soldier come to see him soon at the White House, which Schurz did, arriving early one morning, and was taken at once to an upstairs room where he found the president sitting before an open fire, his feet in large Morocco slippers. Told to pull up a chair, he did so, whereupon Lincoln brought his hand down with a slap on Schurz's knee. "Now tell me, young man, whether you really think that I am as poor a fellow as you have made me out in your letter." He was smiling, but Schurz could not keep from stammering as he tried to apologize. This made the tall man laugh aloud, and again he slapped his visitor's knee. "Didn't I give it to you hard in my letter, didn't I? But it didn't hurt, did it? I did not mean to, and therefore I wanted you to come so quickly." Still laughing, he added, "Well, I guess we understand one another now, and it's all right." They talked for the better part of an hour, and as Schurz rose to leave, he asked whether he should keep on writing letters to the president. "Why, certainly," Lincoln told him. "Write me whenever the spirit moves you." It was Schurz's belief that the visit had done Lincoln good, and unquestionably it had. Busy as he was with the details of office, not all of which were directly connected with the war, he had all too few occasions for relaxation, let alone laughter, the elixir he had always used against his natural melancholia. Out in Minnesota, for example, John Pope had been more successful against the marauding Sioux than he had against Lee and Jackson. He had defeated Chief Little Crow in battle and brought the surviving braves before a military court which sentenced 303 of them to be hanged. Reviewing the list, Lincoln reduced to 38 the number slated for immediate execution and ordered the rest held, taking care that they neither escape nor are subjected to any unlawful violence. This was, of course, only one distraction among many, the most troublesome being the host of importunate callers, all of whom wanted some special favor from him. Sometimes he lost patience, as when he told a soldier who came seeking his intervention in a routine army matter, "Now, my man, go away. I cannot attend to all these details. I could as easily bail out the Potomac with a spoon." But mostly he was patient and receptive. He put them at ease, heard their complaints, and did what he could to help them. When a friend remarked, "You will wear yourself out," he shook his head and replied with a sad smile, "They don't want much, they get but little, and I must see them." One place of refuge he had, the War Telegraph Office, and one companion whose demands on his time apparently brought him nothing but pleasure, Tad. Often he would combine the two, taking his son there with him during the off hours when the place was quiet with only a single operator on duty. He would sit at a desk reading the accumulated flimsies while the 9-year-old went to sleep on his lap or rummaged around in search of mischief, which he seldom failed to find. John Hay once remarked that Tad had a very bad opinion of books and no opinion of discipline. The former was mainly his father's fault. "Let him run," Lincoln said. "There's time enough yet for him to learn his letters and get pokey." So was the latter, for since the death of Willie 8 months before, this youngest child had been overindulged by way of double compensation. "I want to give him all the toys I did not have," Lincoln explained, "and all the toys I would have given the boy who went away." Nor would he allow his son to be corrected. Once, when they were at the telegraph office, Tad wandered into the adjoining room, where he found the combination of black ink and white marble-topped tables quite irresistible. Presently the operator, whose name was Madison Buell, saw what was being done. Indignant at the ruin, he seized the dabbler by the collar and marched him out to his father, pointing through the open door at the irreparable outrage. Lincoln reacted promptly. Rising, he took the boy in his arms, unmindful of the hands still dripping ink. "Come, Tad," he said, "Buell is abusing you," and left. In these and other ways he sought relaxation during this season which had opened with reverses and closed before the big machine could overcome the primary inertia which had gripped it when it stalled. Such large-scale battles as had been fought, Antietam, Corinth, Perryville, had been set down as Union victories, but they had been near things at best, particularly the first and the last, which the rebels also claimed. And what was more, all three had been intrinsically defensive, which would not do. It would do for the insurgents, whose task was merely to defend their region against what they called aggression, but not for the Loyalists, whose goal could be nothing short of conquest. Besides, the defensive encouraged the fulfillment of Lincoln's two worst fears, utter war-weariness at home and recognition for the Confederacy abroad. Other developments might prolong the war, but these two could lose it, and he had taken their avoidance as his personal responsibility. During the period just past, he had sought to prevent the first by appealing directly to the people for confidence in his administration, and to forestall the second by issuing the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. How well he had done in both cases he did not know. It was perhaps too soon to tell, though here too the signs were not encouraging. Some said the fall elections were a rejection of the former, while the latter had been greeted in some quarters, including England, so far as could be judged from the public prints, with derision. He would wait and see, improvising to meet what might arise. Meanwhile, the armies were getting into position at last for another major effort, and incidentally fulfilling the Tribune reporter's prediction about the poetry of war. Down on the Rappahannock, for example, another of Greeley's men overheard the following exchange between two pickets on opposite banks. "Hello, Secesh."
"Hello, Yank."
"What was the matter with your battery Tuesday night?"
"You made it too hot. Your shots drove the cannoneers away, and they haven't stopped running yet. We infantrymen had to come out and withdraw the guns."
"You infantrymen will run too one of these fine mornings." The Confederate picket let this pass, as if to say it might be so, and responded instead with a question.
"When are you coming over, Bluecoat?"
"When we get ready, Butternut."
"What do you want?"
"Want Fredericksburg."
"Don't you wish you may get it?"
2. As if in accordance with the respective limitations of their available resources, which of course applied to men as well as to the food they ate, the powder they burned, and the shoes and clothes and horses they wore out, while Lincoln was getting rid of experienced commanders, Davis was making use of those he had. Yet this difference in outlook and action was not merely the result of any established ratio between profligacy and frugality, affordable on the one hand and strictly necessary on the other. It was rather an outgrowth of the inherent difference in their natures. Lincoln, as he said, was more in need of success than he was in need of sympathy. And while this was also true of Davis, he placed such value on the latter quality, apparently for its own sake, that its demands for reciprocal loyalty, whatever shortcomings there might be in regard to the former, were for him too strong to be denied.
Braxton Bragg and R.E. Lee were cases in point. Ever since the Western general began his retreat from Harrodsburg, Davis had been receiving complaints of dissension in the ranks of the Army of Kentucky, along with insistent demands that its commander be removed, in spite of which, if not indeed because of them, for such agitations often seemed to strengthen instead of weaken Davis's will. The summons Bragg found waiting for him in Knoxville had not been sent with any notion of effecting his dismissal, but rather with the intention of giving him the chance to present in person his side of the reported controversy. When he got to Richmond, October 25th, the president received him with a smile and a congratulatory handshake. On the face of it, both were certainly deserved. The first, because it was not Davis's way to dissolve a friendship or condemn any man on the basis of hearsay evidence, and the second because, of the three offensives designed to push Confederate arms beyond the acknowledged borders of secession, only Bragg's had been even moderately successful. In fact, moderately was putting it all too mildly. Whatever else had been left undone, a campaign which relieved the pressure on Chattanooga and recovered for the Confederacy all of northwest Alabama, as well as eastern and south-central Tennessee, including Cumberland Gap, not to mention the fact that its two columns had inflicted just under 14,000 battle casualties while suffering just over 4,000, and had returned with an enormous train of badly needed supplies and captured materiel, including more than 30 Union guns, could scarcely be called anything less than substantial in its results. What was more, Bragg had conceived and, in conjunction with Kirby Smith, executed the whole thing.